Historian James Bradley joins us this morning. He has written a major new biography of a local guy, as well as the 8th president of the United States, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren was the first chief executive not born a British citizen and the first to use the party system to chart his way from tavern keeper's son to the pinnacle of power. This new biography of Van Buren is the first full-scale portrait in four decades, which charts his ascent from a tavern in the Hudson Valley to the presidency, concluding with his late career involvement in an anti-slavery movement. James Bradley is co-editor of the Martin Van Buren Papers, based at Cumberland University in Lebanon, Tennessee. He's an adjunct instructor in the public history program at the State University of New York at Albany, and was the senior project editor of Encyclopedia of New York City, published by Yale University Press. And it's a great pleasure to welcome James Bradley to the program this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Thank you, Joe.
This is a beautiful book and a very, and I say this lovingly, but exhaustive in the sense of just a good old-fashioned cradle-to-grave biography, right? Which I assume is something that you had felt had been missing from the equation.
Yes, we've seen quite a few books about various aspects of Van Buren's career as a lawyer. We've seen books about his presidency, but there hasn't been in quite some time the conventional cradle-to-grave format that covers his whole life. And I even go back to the 17th century, the first Dutch settlement in New York, because I thought that was very important in this story as well. So I covered a lot of material.
When you look at this this man, it is sometimes he can be a punchline, right?
Yes. We can thank Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David for that.
Right. But
I was hoping not to get into the Van Buren boys here,
well,
but
No. Well, but my point being that there is often a because you don't think of as you're coming out of the founding of this country, and then you get to Martin Van Buren, that there is a story to tell, but perhaps it I didn't find this in this book, but may on the face of it pale in comparison to the earlier stories.
Well, we have this perception of presidents who fell in between Jackson and Lincoln, one-term antebellum presidents who failed to halt the nation's descent into civil war and in some cases actually abetted that. Presidents with mutton chops who were
right. Not...
So we tend to forget them, but there's important history there. And in Martin Van Buren's case, as I make clear in my book, his presidency is not the story of his life. The story of his life is how he changed America's political culture. So how did he change America's political culture? Talk about the world he emerged from in the late 18th century in New York and how he saw political parties as a way of broadening suffrage and broadening people's involvement in the party system and politics in general.
So talk about his early days, because I found this to be fascinating, of going through the ranks of New York state government to the highest ranks, but not for long.
Right, right. His story is really inseparable from, if he had come from any other part in the country, this story never would have materialized in the way he did. He comes of age politically. He's born 1782, right at the birth of America as an independent nation. Mm-hmm. And he, in the early 19th century, he starts to get involved in local politics and he starts to work his way up the ranks at the local level, county level, statewide. And during this period, he has this incredible rivalry with DeWitt Clinton, who is the powerful governor of New York. And during these battles, Van Buren formulates the party system as a way of fighting Clintonism, because he sees DeWitt Clinton as someone of more of the Federalist bent of the late 18th century. And Van Buren comes across during this period as somebody who sees himself as more of a Jeffersonian type politician. So how do we take these principles of Jefferson and how do we incorporate it into larger government? How do we get people more involved in political parties? So this was sort of all of these things came together, and he learned how to harness this and to build a political career. That's really been the template for politics ever since.
When you think about the struggles that he had during this time, we were learning a lot, not only about him and about his political power, but about political power.
Right.
And that is interesting because there's a lot of really key lessons that were learned.
Yes, yes. Political power was such a nebulous thing at this time in our nation's history. There were corporations, but they didn't quite exert this level of power that they do today. So for Van Buren, so much of this was about ideas, was about what are the sort of policies that are going to broaden democracy in New York. And of course, at first, that's what he was thinking of, New York. He goes to Washington and tries to take these lessons learned from New York and apply them on the national scale. But in New York, a lot of them had to do with roads, canals. We're about to celebrate the bicentennial of the Erie Canal in October. The Erie Canal was an enormously controversial and polarizing issue in New York at that time. And Van Buren and Clinton had this sort of back and forth jockeying going on over the Erie Canal because so much of it involved jobs, so much of it involved money. It was really used to get people more involved in the political system. So from early on, we get to see how infrastructure, how this was a way of building political power as well. So.
Last week, we had an event, a WAMC on the Road event in Kinderhook, and we were going down to talk to former Congressman Chris Gibson. And so two things. One was I got to visit the home in Kinderhook.
Lindenwald,
mm-hmm. which is where he went after his time in the White House.
That's right, after the presidency.
And that is a fascinating, beautiful place that I would heartily recommend anyone to see because you learn so much about him, as well as the horticulture and of the time and the space. Chris Gibson and I, the thing we were talking about before we did our little dog and pony show, because we had both just read the first chapter of your book, which was so much about Kinderhook and a fascinating look at this place that really shapes Martin Van Buren very much. And almost he shapes it too, doesn't he?
Yes. And the thing about Kinderhook is this is all happening in the backdrop of the American Revolution. Van Buren's father is a tavern keeper. Taverns play an enormous role in the American Revolution. It's not just where citizens gathered and met and discussed issues, but it's where the militia met. It's where strategy was planned out. They were really the center of a town's activity. And Van Buren's father was a patriot. Kinderhook was largely loyalist, though. So when you look at Kinderhook, it sort of gave the model for Van Buren in the sense that to be an outsider in your own town, when you see democracy in action, which is what he had in his own house, you know, this was a polling site. Elections were held there. It was really the center of political activity. So all of this had a profound effect on his political outlook because he could see what citizens were capable of doing because he was witnessing. It was taking place in his house, and he later learns how to develop that into a broader vision for a system of parties. And the other thing about Kinderhook and this whole region of the patroons and manor lords is that it was a region of great inequality because voting was tied to ownership of property. And if you didn't own property, you were completely shut out of the political system. Now, Van Buren's family, they did own property and they could vote, but it was a reminder to him of how fragile things were. And he really wanted to take this and sort of make it permanent and broaden it through New York, which was always sort of going through this back and forth about balancing suffrage and voting rights and policies.
You talked about the difficulty of being a one-term president in that time up until Abraham Lincoln, but what were what was he able to achieve that he was not able to turn into a victory when it comes to reelection?
During his presidency, the nation was mired in a devastating economic crisis. That was the big story of his 4 years in office. Now, presidents were never really held accountable for the state of the economy before because it was considered something outside their powers. But things were different in the late 1830s when he's president. There's not only a more vibrant party system in place that he helped put in place, but there was also this belief that his predecessor, Andrew Jackson, his policies put the nation in this economic crisis. And he couldn't quite get the nation out of it, largely because he wanted to keep Jackson's policies in place because he didn't want to upset the coalition that helped elect him president. So this sort of juggling act of keeping your constituents happy within the party at the same time trying to address the nation as a whole was something he couldn't quite get out of. So that's sort of why his presidency was a very unhappy 4 years.
When he comes back to Kinderhook, he decides he wants to run again. He runs twice, right?
Right. He's convinced that the election was stolen from him, that there was a lot of voter fraud going on in 1840.
Do they come up with this stuff?
It's really extraordinary when you read this stuff about how similar things were to the 2020 election. But there really was this belief that the Whigs were stuffing the ballot boxes and that they were whisking people to polling site after polling site. But Van Buren also just thought that it was an extraordinary sort of tornado of events that led to his defeat. Things would be different in 1844. This issue of Texas comes up. Should Texas be annexed to become part of the United States? He bucks most of his party and says no. This is too thorny of an issue right now, admitting this large slaveholding republic into the United States. His own party rebels against him. He loses the nomination in 1844 to James Polk, who becomes the next president. James Polk is this great expansionist president who doubles the size of the United States in his one term. In 1848, Van Buren runs for president again. This time, he spurns his own Democratic Party, his own creation, and he runs for president on the Free Soil ticket, the party that wants to make sure that any land acquired as a result of the Mexican War does not have slavery in it. So this sort of late career change in him sort of sets in motion anti-slavery politics, which was considered a radical extreme position. He works it into the larger political framework of America that leads to the Republican Party and, of course, the ascent of Abraham Lincoln.
The last point I'd like to talk to you about as we're running out of time, but In that time when he is at Lyndon Walden, he's there, and running, but also very much working on these issues, right? I mean, very much a part and thinking about, and I believe the way it was explained to me by the ranger at the property was that this was his political center, this place where he was welcoming guests, he was working on projects, and I guess that's to build a coalition, certainly.
Yes, of course. It was hard to get around at this period in history. This train travel has not quite reached this area,
right.
So everything was still through carriage. So this was his home. This was where his family was, and his family, they were involved in politics as well. It's where the letters arrived and where people would travel to meet with him and discuss strategy and things like that. So it was the clearinghouse sort of for activity.
But more to the point, my question being as far as his political capital, even though he lost the election, were people still seeking his advice and thought on these issues? And how much was he able to advance those thoughts into the national conversation?
After the 1848 election, no. He drops out of politics. And at this time, ex-presidents were generally not solicited for their advice very much. This is something that really comes later. So in the 1850s, he's dealing with personal problems. One of his sons is very ill. Right. He dies in 1855. He goes to Europe. He also works on his memoirs and he works on his papers. So he's working on securing his legacy, and he sees the nation coming apart and he sees his legacy slipping away. So the last years of his life are a very unhappy life. He dies in July of 1862 when the war is going very badly for the North. His Democratic Party looks like its future is very much in doubt. His nation looked like it was very much in doubt. So his last few years at Kinderhook were not a happy one on many levels for him.
Dies at 79 years old at the house.
Yes.
Yeah. And my final question, and I know I said the last question was going to be the final question, but I find all of this just fascinating. But as the papers, how did they? You are co-editor of the Martin Van Buren papers,
right? I don't live in Lebanon, Tennessee, by the way.
Yes, yeah. but Cumberland University is, yes, in Lebanon, Tennessee. How did they wind up with the papers?
Well, I was fortunate to meet a scholar named Mark Cheatham, who's the director of. He's a professor of history and a Jacksonian scholar. And we struck up this friendship, and we addressed this issue of a gap in the historical record, which is Martin Van Buren's papers are the only president whose papers have never been published and have never even been digitized. So we are going through the process right now of taking his papers, transcribing, editing, annotating, putting them online. We're going to have letterpress editions as well. But vanburenpapers.org, if I may give a shout out,
please.
That's where people can go because they're free and open to the public.
Vanburenpapers.org, and what I heard is that he had lousy handwriting.
He had terrible handwriting. But look, you know, you get used to them after a while.
But mostly in English, although some Dutch, right?
No, this is a controversial point that I seem to get into trouble with. A lot of people think Dutch was his first language. I'm not convinced of this. There's no Dutch in his letters
there
at
isn't.
All. No.
Okay.
No. So I think when he grew up, he probably heard some Dutch as well, was probably conversant and familiar with it, but was it his first language? I doubt that. But in his letters, no, there's no writing in Dutch.
The name of the book, which is just phenomenal, is Martin Van Buren, America's First Politician. The book is published by Oxford University Press. James Bradley is the author. James, thank you so much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you, Joe. My pleasure.
Be well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.